a short reading by Gary Dawes. When the animals come to us asking for our help, will we know what they are saying? When the plants speak to us in their delicate, beautiful language, will we be able to answer them? When the planet herself sings to us in our dreams, will we be able to wake ourselves and act? And now I'll turn it over to Eric to talk about the science of all this.
Thanks, Mom. This is the first time I've ever said that before. It's very nice to be here today. We used to come here when I was a lad, but it's nice to be back from Barcelona, where we live now. I'm a scientist, and I've been giving mostly technical talks lately, so this is going to have more graphs than the previous part of the service. So hopefully you'll take something away that's interesting and useful for you. And I apologize if it's some information overload. Here we go. So I'd like to talk about just some things that I'm trying to work on now. As a scientist, you know, being inspired by these issues of environmental problems and dealing with a planet that's becoming full of people. So there are now more than 7 billion people in the world, and we're heading towards 10 or 11 billion people later this century. And that's a lot. And we don't really know how we're going to continue to thrive and live well on this planet. There's a lot of environmental issues that basically happen at the interface between the natural world and the human world. And I feel that, you know, so I've been studying the natural world as a natural scientist for a couple decades. But I feel that part of the problem in addressing environmental issues is that we study the natural world separately from the social science world. And, you know, the reason for that is because there's just so much knowledge in the world today that the individual knowledge has become very fragmented. I think if you imagine going back in time to, the Middle Ages or ancient Greece, it was possible for a person to know everything that there was to know in their society. You know, through a life of study, you can become an expert in law, in medicine, in botany, in everything. Like, you could know all there was to know, and you had a complete kind of knowledge of many things that way. But as time has gone on, you know, the sphere of formal knowledge within the global community has expanded way beyond, you know, orders and orders of magnitude beyond what any single person can know in their head. So on the one hand, we know a lot as a community, but individual people know only a tiny fragment. And that becomes a real problem when you have politicians who need to make decisions based on what a few advisors tell them, and those advisors are economists who only study a certain kind of economics. And, you know, we have all these important decisions being made by people with tiny, fragmentary, expert knowledge. You know, people say, you know, more and more, but less and less. So I was kind of inspired for a way around this, maybe, by working with climate models. I worked in Princeton for a few years with people who build these global climate models in order to study how the ocean and the atmosphere interact with each other in order to try and understand how climate change works and, you know, how these aspects of the natural world work. So this is showing the ocean circulation just through the sea surface temperature, you know, this part of the world, from a very complex model that runs on a huge computer, and it has a three-dimensional ocean circulation based on all of these physical principles, and atmosphere based on physical and chemical principles all circulating around, and it all runs together as an integrated system. And what's really interesting about these kinds of models, I think, is that they get over this problem of fragmentary knowledge by putting many people's knowledge together into basically computer programs. So it's a way to deal with, you know, there being so much knowledge that no individual person can have it. So instead, people put their individual knowledge into a computer program that then combines how these different components interact together. And so, even though there is no single person who understands how these climate models work top to bottom, nobody does. But instead, you know, the climate models are built as these community cooperative efforts, really, that combine many people's knowledge. But, you know, what struck me in working with these things is, you know, we're building these models because we're concerned about environmental issues, but nobody puts humans inside these models, because the study of the natural world has just been carried on for the last century in isolation from the study of the human world. You don't get people crossing back and forth between these fields. And they're very different kinds of personalities. You know, the physical scientists want to simplify things to predict a principle so that you can say, you know, if you fire a rocket into space, where is it going to land? Or if we increase the CO2 in the atmosphere by this much, how is it going to change planetary temperature? Whereas social scientists tend to be fascinated by the complexity of humans and social interactions. And so they don't try for prediction. In many fields, it's a dirty word. You don't want to predict. You know, humans are unpredictable by nature, and therefore they don't try and take the same approach. And of course, for many things, they're right. But at the same time, I feel like there's a lack of integration that means that we miss a lot. You know, there's these gaps between the natural science way of looking at things and the social science way of looking at things. So anyway, let me just get this between graphs. So I've been working on the system of the global fishery as kind of a way to think about coupling together the natural and the social science ways of looking at things, because I think it's interesting in its own right, and it's also very important. The global fishery provides a lot of important nourishment to people, especially in poor countries. There's a lot of poor people in the world whose only source of animal protein is from fish that they basically go and catch themselves every day. That's for about 100 million people in the world, so three times the population of Canada, that's their main supply of animal protein. So, if you look at so we just heard the Sam Rogers song about the collapse of fisheries, we hear a lot about that, particularly in this part of the world. The fish harvest is quite low compared to what it was in the 1960s or the 1970s. But you may find it surprising that if you look globally at the total amount of fish that's been caught, we're catching today about as much fish as have ever been caught. As far as we can tell, it's hard to know exactly how much fish are being caught everywhere. But we're roughly catching about 120 million tons of fish per year or something, which is about as much as it has ever been caught. And so this graph here is showing from 1950 through to 2010, the latest numbers are available. You can see that there was an increase in how much fish people were catching. This is just wild fish out in the ocean. How much people were catching every year up to about 1990. And since then, it's been kind of flat. So this is interesting because people have studied a lot the individual fisheries. Right? There have been these very focused views on, you know, the Nova Scotian fishery, the Newfoundland fishery, the British Columbia fishery, Peruvian fishery, like all these individual ones. But so I was interested, together with a few colleagues, to try and put together a simple global model that included the physics, included the biology, and also included the social aspects, in order to try and understand why the history of fishing has looked this way, so that we can then try and predict how it will change in the future, depending on different societal choices. So I won't go into the details here. If anybody's interested, I'd be happy to talk about it. But we start with phytoplankton, which are the source of all energy in the oceans. So they capture the sunlight energy, they convert it into their cells, and then that provides food for everything else in most of the ocean. A little bit grows from kelp and seagrasses, but mostly it's coming from these microscopic plant-like algae. And they're very tiny. And so to get up to the fish that we eat, those have to pass through this trophic web, where they go through little bugs, you know, the zooplankton in the ocean, and then they get eaten by larval fish, and then little fish, and then the big fish eat the little one. And as that energy goes through the ecosystem, most of it gets lost. And so you can make some predictions for how that energy would flow through this web of the ocean ecosystem to tell you how many fish would be out there in the ocean. And so we spent a long time perfecting this. I think it works pretty well now. So this is our calculation that comes out for the pristine fish biomass. So this is how much there would have been before anybody started fishing. This is an estimate. So you can see it's in tons of fish per square kilometer. So this is all fish bigger than about this. All fish bigger than about 10 centimeters. So you can see, you know, most of the ocean has less than one ton or something like one or a couple tons per square kilometer. And then there's some places that had a lot of fish, like up to 1,000 tons per square kilometer. And you can see, actually, if you look closely, I don't know if you can see from where you're sitting, but maybe if you can see the water around Nova Scotia and Newfoundland is very high. It's about as high as it was anywhere in the world. But also in the North Sea, it was very high, and the Yellow Sea, so China. But so this really was one of the very, you know, this is consistent with being, you know, very rich waters here. It was difficult to sail a boat through, or it was very dear shore, because there really was a huge amount of fish here at the beginning, probably. So then we take this basically biophysical model. So this is driven by the physics, the ecosystem, and then we include humans just in a very simple way. So really just including them in the same way as the rest of the ecosystem, so that at each point on the world, there's an amount of fishing that just depends on the profitability of fishing. So given the price of fish, the cost of going out fishing, and basically how good you are at fishing, depends on your fishing technology, like how nice your boat is, how good your fishing gear is, how well you know where to get to the fish, and how well you know how to use your equipment, all that stuff. That determines how hard people are going to try and fish, and therefore how much fish they catch. Make sense? Great. So then we can do the same kinds of experiments with this as people can do with climate models, but now here it's including a human, humans basically within the same conceptual picture. So I showed you before what the real global wild fish harvest looks like. So if we now take this model and we try and reproduce the history of what happened in the fishery just by including changes in market forces. So that would be the observed changes in the price. So how much did the price of fish change? Does anybody know how the price of fish changed, more or less? The price that fishermen got? You just average all fish prices that all fishermen in the world have gotten since 1950. You might think it's gone up a lot, but nope, you're right. It's basically flat. Basically, the price of fish has been $1 per kilo, once you correct for inflation, since 1950. It's hardly changed at all. So that has not driven the increase in fishing. It's not that there are higher prices now, which tells you that it's not due to population growth on its own or anything like that. The cost of fishing actually increased due to oil prices, and that's complicated, but if you look at the shape of, if you just try and explain the history of fishing with changes in fishing cost, it goes the wrong way. That doesn't explain what happens. But then if you look what happens with technological progress, just increasing the ability of people to catch fish year after year by a few percent, you see, you get shapes that look much more like what really did happen. And you see that in the middle one there, there's kind of a 2% progress rate, 8% progress rate at the bottom, and in the middle there's 5% progress. And if you look at that closely, you see that it actually matches the history of fishing pretty well. And that's interesting because that's about what people estimate when they go and study fisheries very carefully. They find that in general, people get about 5% better year after year at catching fish. That's just, just look over 20 years. Because it goes in steps as new boats come, as new types of gear come, as cell phones become available, as sonars become distributed, as people get radar, all of these things. When you average it out, it's about 5% per year. What this tells you is that, okay, you know, the global fishery is very complicated. There's thousands of different species. There's many different communities. There's subsidies. There's, changes in prices and international markets and airplanes flying fish all over the world. There's all these things. But they don't really matter. The only thing that really matters is how good people are catching fish. and we just become better and better and better at doing it until the point where we've arrived at today. And as we've seen, you know, locally around here, as in many other places, at some point we became so good at catching fish that we caught too many, and then the ecosystem collapsed. That's definitely what happened here in the 1970s and 1980s. So now we have this global model, so we can ask, you know, what would be the predictions of this simple global model going forward into the future? So here, I've just expanded the view here on this plot. So this is showing the same thing, basically, we just saw a minute ago. I told you there was going to be a lot of plots. This is the same thing from a minute ago, but now I've expanded it out to the year 2100. So going from 1950 to 2100. You can see that it you know, gave this increase to about 1990, and then it was kind of flat after that. But if we continue to have 5% per year progress, if we continue to get better and better at catching fish through into the future all around the world, it predicts that, just as happened here in Nova Scotia, globally, we'll see this collapse in fisheries because we just extract too much, and the ocean can't support itself. Basically, there won't be enough adults in all the communities to produce eggs that are required to replace the fish that we keep taking up as we get better and better at catching fewer and fewer fish. So, but what we can also do with the model is we can ask, okay, what if instead of everybody just racing out to get the fish without any control, what if we had perfect management? So what if you could instead make sure that everybody in the world was cooperating so that they were just catching the maximum amount of fish that they could without depleting the ecosystem too much to keep it balanced? This is called maximum sustainable yield in fisheries world. So if you could do that with a constant climate, with no climate change, then you would get basically a straight line that would do this. So this is kind of the best case scenario. So we can see the best case scenario is actually better than we've had since 1990. So globally, around the world, if you could perfectly manage all fisheries, if societies take it themselves together and police the fisheries well, and everybody could cooperate, we could have more fish than we do today. A little bit. But climate change does affect this, so if we don't do anything about climate change and the expected changes happen in the ocean, it will probably decrease that. So this is the guess of the model. So if we go on what's called the RCP 8.5 scenario, which is a lot of climate warming, well, actually, it lowers the ceiling of what we could go to. So that's the, anyway, that's the prediction there. So, but, and, oh right, and so this is all assuming that there are continuing improvements in fishing technology, which I think is absolutely inevitable. I mean, the first thing is that there's just going to be more deployment of existing technology. So most of the fishermen in the world are using little boats with little nets, a lot of them rowing or sailing with themselves. So as existing technology moves into developing nations and they become better at catching fish, they're going to destroy their ecosystems. So that's going to happen. And that's something that's done. There are these fish aggregating devices that have become very common for catching tuna, where basically you put out floating robots with little rafts, and the fish like to come and swim underneath these. So they gather underneath these things, and then you can just go out with the boat and scoop up the fish. So those are becoming better. There's now tens of thousands of those around the world. Those are expanding rapidly. There's fish models that, I guess we're contributing to this accidentally, but we're almost like weather models where people will be able to predict where fish are going to be so that you can go out and catch them more efficiently. Maybe at some point there's going to be drones, who knows, where you can send robots out to do your fishing for you, which then of course will make it more profitable again. So, and many other things that I can't imagine, but the thing about this is because people aren't used to looking at this whole system in a simple way, nobody thinks about future technology changes, right? Everybody is very reactive. You know, everybody's always dealing with the technological changes from 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I think we need to be proactive and see that see how the whole system works, because it can be better. And finally, I think that the fisheries really shows what I think is the most important. Maybe I'd be curious if anybody has thoughts about this, but I think this is maybe the most important thing in considering global environmental problems, the fact that we have this planet now that's full of people, I think that it's really all about this tension between technological innovation and societal behavior. So technological innovation really causes all environmental problems. Before any technological innovation, we were simple apes living among the ecosystem. We were just nondescript, just like everything else. We're less interesting than lions. But with all of this technological innovation, we've done lots of great things, wonderful things. But we've also created these environmental problems. But all the environmental problems that we have solved, because we've solved very many, we've solved lots of sewage problems, lots of garbage products, we've solved the CFC problem, there are many problems that we've solved, but it's always through societal behavior. So there's just always this. So understanding that dynamic, I think, is really important. How those things feed back. How can you make the societal behavior change quickly and effectively in order to deal with the technological innovations as they're happening, rather than wait 20 or 30 years until the problems grow out of control and then trying to deal with them. So those are my thoughts about that.